Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Stephen Wolfram. Stephen is the creator of Mathematica, Wolfram Alpha, and the Wolfram Language. He's the author of A New Kind of Science and the founder and CEO of Wolfram Research. Over the course of nearly four decades, Stephen has been a pioneer in the development and application of computational thinking and has been responsible for many discoveries, inventions, and innovations in science, technology, and business. It's really great to have you, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Nice to be here.
Yes, it's really great to connect with you again. I know that you have many things you're involved with, and what we like to hear about some of the tools that you use, like in your daily productive way that you are, and we're looking forward to hearing. I know that you had a blog post recently where you at length talked about the many tools that you use in your capacity as a remote worker. We'd like to hear about some of those.
That was so cool. I loved that post so much. Very generous post, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thanks. I mostly wrote it because we were just finishing a big new version of our product, and the parts that I needed to work on were done. And I was going crazy because I didn't really have anything to do. So I thought, I've been meaning to write this post for ages. I should actually get it written now.
What are some of those favorite tools that you use to keep you so productive?
Oh gosh, it's a long story. But I mean, I'm a remote CEO, have been for 29 years now. And a lot of what I end up doing is kind of thinking in public, so to speak. So I'm figuring stuff out with my teams and so on. But I'm doing that kind of with just screen sharing and communicating via audio. But I'm kind of figuring stuff out with people in public, so to speak. It's kind of the image of, oh, I'll just go off and figure that out, is something I don't like to do. I like to actually show the process of figuring things out, because I think that ends up being more productive and more educational for everybody, and we make better decisions and so on.
And what's a tool that you use that you find really essential in doing that? What's one of those tools?
Oh, I'm just using screen sharing. I mean, that's those tools are kind of mundane. I think that a lot of what I do, there's a lot of tools we built ourselves, which aren't really available to other people, at least not yet. I mean, I would say that in terms of my kind of interesting daily life tools, you know, I have to talk about one that we built that is available, has been available as of the end of this, has now been available for a whole decade to the world, which is Wolfram Alpha. Wolfram Alpha is a thing for answering questions using computational knowledge, and I use it every day for all kinds of things. Like, you know, if I'm going to walk outside, which I like to do, and I have this crazy setup for typing on my computer while walking around outside and so on. But, you know, one of the things about walking outside is, am I going to get sunburned? And so I go to Wolfram Alpha, usually on my phone, and just type in sunburn, and it will figure out, based on where I am and predictions for UV index and so on, plus, you know, skin type data and so on, what the expected time for me to get sunburned is. And I've been doing this now for probably close to 10 years. And it's a great form of kind of quality assurance for our product, right? Every time I go outside, I decide I'm going to walk for 1 hour and 30 minutes outside. And that's the time it tells me it'll take for me to get sunburned. And I haven't got sunburned yet. Whenever I've actually believed it a few times, I'm like, it doesn't know what it's talking about.
So you said that this was a tool available, the Wolfram Alpha was a tool available for everyone. So what would one of our listeners or myself need to do to type in the word sunburn and get that kind of reply customized to me and my where I'm living, et cetera. So what would the person need to do to
you
do
just
that?
Go to wolframalpha.com on the web or on a phone and type in the word sunburn and you'll get these results. If your computer,
how does it know where I am? Or does
if it's on a phone, it knows where you are. If it's on a computer, if your GeoIP is not correct, then it'll actually. I just tried it actually here, and it gave me a thing where it said where it thought I was, but it doesn't believe that, so it actually let me type in a different location if I want to.
And so then it gives you kind of advice.
Well, it just gives you a kind of info, information presentation. It's a table of, given your skin type, no sunscreen. It says right now, because it's nighttime here, it says sunburn unlikely for all skin types. So that's good. But if I do, for example, sunburn in, Timbuktu, for example, I'm kind of guessing, well, is night in Timbuktu? I'm not sure. It's night in Timbuktu, but
you can still get sunburn.
it'll get light soon enough, so it's like 7 hours to sunburn. Let's do it for San Francisco. It's probably
it's still light out here.
Yeah, it's still light out there. So it's 5:37. Oh, no sunburn today. There are all kinds of things. Like here's another thing you can do. You can just go to Wolfram Alpha and type in some first name, like Kevin, for example. And this is a good party trick. It's because it knows how many people called Kevin have been born every year since the late 1800s, and it knows mortality tables and so on. It can figure out what the distribution of Kevins in America is, and says the most common age for a Kevin in America is 47 years, and there are about 1 million Kevins in America. It's a good guess when you're talking to somebody, particularly with a slightly unusual name, that they will be an age that's really close to the most common age.
So when I typed in my name, my full name, it told me that it knew it was me for some reason, even though there are, I don't know how many other Kevin Kellys there are.
I think it thinks you're the most famous one, I'm afraid. It's not, it seems to offer Kevin Kelly the editor, Kevin Kelly the politician.
Right, so it just assumed that it was me, I guess, and giving me my age, my place of birth, my children.
Is it right?
Yes.
Good.
Yes. Appeared in the Welcome to the Machine. That's not correct.
Interesting.
Maybe that is. Maybe that's a documentary I appeared in. Who knows? Correct the books it got me. It's assuming that, but it doesn't tell me how many Kevin Kellys there are, like it did with Kevin, right?
It probably knows how. No, it does not know that. It knows how many Kellys there are. It knows how many Kevins there are, but it won't know how many Kevin Kellys there are.
Because there's a lot of Kevin Kellys. There's a whole website that we made of all the Kevin Kellys on the internet. How would I ask it how many Kevin Kellys there are?
Well, it's not going to know. I mean, so I just asked it how many Kellys there are. It says there are about 260,000 people called Kelly, and it knows. So I mean, what it's doing, we've been collecting knowledge about the world for the last, I don't know, few decades, and trying to make that knowledge computable so that we can do things like, when you type in the name Kevin, it's not just giving you, this is what the database says. It's actually computing, this is the number of Kevins who should be alive now, and this is the distribution of their ages and so on. And we've been doing that across a zillion different domains, from chemicals to cities to movies to things about tire pressures, or things about material, radiation, earthquakes, whatever, all these different kinds of things, and trying to make the knowledge about those things computable in the sense that if there is a question that can be answered from this public knowledge, we should be able to automatically answer the question. That's kind of the goal. And people, I mean, you know, our Wolfram Alpha powers kind of the knowledge component of Siri and now also of Alexa. And so it's kind of the, we've sort of been the unique place that's been trying to make knowledge about the world computable. Okay. But from my point of view, you know, I end up using Wolfram Alpha every day to figure out sort of things that are either I'm curious about or that I need to make some decision. Like I was trying to think, what had I actually done in the last couple of days? Well, I was, for some reason, I was thinking about the number 10 to the 20th, and I was trying to explain to somebody roughly how big that number is. So I type it into Wolfram Alpha, and it tells me that's roughly the number of grains of sand on Earth, which is, I'm not sure how useful that is, but at least some way of getting an idea of how big that number is.
Okay. So that's a great tool. What's another tool that you're using these days?
Well, let's see. Another thing is something.
You mentioned that you were walking around outside with your computer with some kind of strap or something. Was that something you invented yourself, or is that something you bought? Is that a tool?
I think you can buy them off the internet. They go by names like walking desk and so on. I had only figured out recently that this was something that would actually work.
You can type while you're walking?
Absolutely. No, I mean, the thing I figured out like a decade ago is that you can type while you're walking on a treadmill.
That's a little safer, it would seem to me, than walking down a path.
Yeah, people believe that typing on a treadmill, that you can't do it when you're walking at more than like half a mile an hour, but that's not true. You can do it up to about 2.5 miles an hour. And that it just depends on having the right mechanics for, you know, how you support your wrists and so on and all that. You know, in terms of walking outside, I have to say that I was realizing I'm lucky enough to have a decently large plot of land that doesn't have other people on it that I can walk around, so to speak. So that prevents certain kinds of, there's a strange thing I didn't know was there. Uh-huh. that I'm going to trip over. But right. I think my theory is that I have good enough peripheral vision, you know, with this, that I actually wouldn't trip over anything. But at least, you know, I've been doing this for 6 months or something, and so far I haven't tripped over anything. But now, having said that, you know, tomorrow I'll have some disaster.
And what about the oftentimes the screens and sunlight are maybe not bright enough, but is yours, are you able to overcome that kind of working in the sunlight on a screen?
Yeah, you have to not tip the screen so it's too big of an angle.
Okay.
Sometimes you have to, if it's really bright sunlight, you have to kind of angle the screen so that the sun's not catching it, so to speak. I actually, it's an interesting point. Maybe I should make a little sort of sunshade for my computer.
Well, I was just wondering if you had done it. Device.
No, I haven't needed it, but okay. It's a good theory. No, I have noticed if I like have a tablet or something, an iPad or something, right on the desk, that doesn't work quite as well for that reason.
And do you find there's any limit to how long you can spend walking and typing, or is it sort of like, is it tiring, or is it actually you're at a point where you can just kind of do it as long as you wanted to?
Well, I typically do it for 2 hours, and it doesn't seem to be.
Wow.
Doesn't seem to be timing out by that time. I mean, I it's not, I don't type as efficiently when I'm doing that as I do when I'm, you know, sitting at my desk or standing at my desk or something, but it's certainly workable. And I tend to, I'm often doing meetings where I'm screen sharing, and I'll be typing some stuff in the screen share, and sometimes watching sometimes watching other people do things and so on.
I see. So you're actually maybe in a conversation at the same time as
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
yes, I'm walking and talking. Yes.
So not only are you remote, but you're actually mobily pedestrian remote.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's true.
Two times remote. Remote squared.
Right. And the theory is nobody can really tell, what state one's in, and it's still just...
Well, you can be walking right now for all we know, except to...
That's true. The one thing I haven't yet done is that... So I've been doing a lot of live streaming of our internal meetings, actually. This is something I started about a year and a bit ago of our sort of designing our software and so on is something that I think is a pretty interesting intellectual process, and it kind of ranges from... sort of sophisticated questions in science and philosophy and so on to software engineering. And I always find it pretty interesting. And I thought, like a bit more than a year ago, I thought, gosh, maybe other people would find this interesting as well. So we started just live streaming on Twitch and Facebook Live and YouTube Live and so on, these internal meetings. And that's been great, because it's actually even useful for us just to have a record of them. But we found lots of interesting and sophisticated people kind of tune in, and we get kind of good real-time feedback on lots of things. It's really a good process. But the thing I haven't yet done, the extreme case is I haven't yet done a live-streamed public meeting while I'm walking. And maybe that's something I still have to. That's a level I still haven't gone to. But
How would you get connectivity that way? Do you have a mobile hotspot, or do you link it up to your phone's cell connection?
Okay. The as I said, I'm mostly walking around my own property, and so I must admit that there are Wi-Fi repeaters stuck in trees.
Right.
So, right. That's
it will soon be 5G, I'm sure, right?
Yes. Yeah. If it was 5G, it'd probably be easier. This is traditional Wi-Fi.
So you have Wi-Fi up in the tree. So the trees are wired with AC power up the trunks to hotspots.
Yeah, and at some point, we also like painted the hotspots, so you can't really notice.
Yeah, of course. So Stephen, you run a high-tech company, and you're doing this remote, and you mentioned live streaming. But one of the technologies that I keep waiting to happen, and it doesn't seem to come each year, which is really good teleconferencing that works. Have you encountered that at all? Is that something you're interested in?
I never use it. It's terrible. We've had fancy video conferencing capabilities forever. And, every so often, sort of for fun, I'll try using it. And it actually has a negative effect on most meetings I do, because, I'll be in some meeting with 20 people or something. And, the point of having the people there is that they can give their opinion when it's needed. But some fraction of the time, they don't even need to be paying attention. If I see 20 little images of people not paying attention, it's an immediate, killer to the mood of any meeting. So I find that not so useful. And I've experimented with lots of telepresence robots and things like that, and they're amusing, but I stop using them after a very short time. I've just found screen sharing plus audio is a much more effective way to work.
Yeah.
Stephen, could you tell me about the motion sickness glasses that you just mentioned as a link in that long blog post? You didn't write about them, but the picture of them is intriguing.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm sort of surprised they work, but I keep on using them and they keep on working. So they are... they're glasses that I got from some French startup. They kind of have fluid in little kind of circular containers. And the idea is that the fluid in the glasses responds to the effective gravity of where you are. And so when a car is turning, for example, that will always sort of maintain a correct sort of artificial horizon for you. And it's kind of is bizarrely reminiscent of what one imagines is actually going on in the semicircular canals in one's ear. Mm-hmm. But somehow seeing that outside one's, with one's eyes, somehow helps convince one's brain that everything is okay. And it's been quite interesting, you know, it's probably added many hours of productive work to my life, being able to use a computer and not get carsick.
That is amazing. My wife and daughter need those, or I need them to give to my wife and daughter badly.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wish I'd discovered this like 30 years ago or something. I probably would have had many different habits.
We have time for another tool. Is there something else that you use on a kind of a daily basis that you find really essential or gives you pleasure? We haven't talked much about what you do for fun or what kinds of things give you pleasure. What's a tool that you just look forward to even using?
Well, I mean, I use this thing called Waltham Language, which is what I've been building for the last 30-something years. And I use that for lots of time every day. And it's kind of at some level, it's intended to be, at least in the software world, kind of a tool to end all tools, so to speak, because it's, you know, the goal of our language is to kind of automate as much as possible, which is kind of and to make it so that one is as closely as possible going from kind of forming a computational thought about what one wants to do to actually being able to get the computer to automatically execute things. And that's kind of, every day I'll write, you know, Waltham Language code to do all kinds of different things, whether it's, I was trying to figure out something for a birthday party for myself that I'm doing. So it's like ingest a bunch of data about people and geolocations and compute various things from it. And that's something that is the whole, the goal is to make it automatic enough that that's something one can readily do. I mean, I think the thing that happens, and it happens also with Waltham Alpha, is that if one makes one's tools good enough and streamlined enough, there are things that one chooses to do that one would never have bothered to do otherwise.
That's true.
I mean, if it's going to take me an hour to figure out how to write a piece of code, to do this thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I'll never do it. But if it's going to take me 3 minutes, then sure, I'll just do it and see what happens. And if I don't get what I expected to get, well, then I'll change it and it'll take me another minute and then I'll get what I really want.
So what kind of people or occupations or examples are that you found for other power users of Waltham language? Are they like scientists? Are they other coders? Are there people who are researchers? Who are some of the other power users of the Waltham language?
Lots of high-end R&D folk, lots of people in education, lots of students.
So like a teacher would be, you say in education, like a professor doing...
Yeah, like, I mean, what kind a of, decent kind of fraction. So like in something like physics or mathematics, I would say most people who do those fields use our language. When you see papers that are published and things and they have, you know, some complicated calculation, there's a good probability that that was done using our language. It's pretty neat because over the last few decades, just all kinds of stuff has been discovered and invented with these tools I've made. And it's very personally satisfying that the tools one makes, you know, allow interesting things to happen in the world like that. I mean, I think that the thing that nowadays, among the many directions that things are going in, one thing I really like are what I call computational essays, because one of the points of the Waltham language is that it's a language that can be read not only by computers, but also by humans. It's kind of like the analogy is, you know, a few hundred years ago, people invented math notation. Before that time, if you wanted to write down some mathematical fact, you had to use your natural language, Latin or whatever it is, to write it down. And then people invented math notation, and suddenly it was possible to write down, explain, communicate math in a streamlined way. And that's what launched things like algebra and calculus and so on. So similarly, now we have kind of a way to represent computational thoughts in a streamlined way that both computer can understand and humans can understand. And that means that we get sort of a new way to communicate information, which is these things I call computational essays, which are kind of a mixture of, you know, a little piece of text and then a piece of computational language, and then often the output from running that piece of computational language. And that's kind of a so humans can read both the text that says something in words and the computational language that says something in computational form, so to speak. And that's a very powerful sort of way to work and way to communicate things. And a thing I've been doing recently is a big book that I wrote now 17 years ago about, it's called A New Kind of Science, that is about sort of exploring the computational universe of what programs can do. But I made a bunch of notebooks that are essentially computational essays when I was writing that book. And I've just been kind of pulling those all out, and I'm about to be putting them all on the web, so other people can kind of reproduce what I did and such like. And that's something that's sort of made possible by having a computational language where humans can read it as well as computers being able to read it. So that's a real important thing in my in the kinds of things that I do.
And Stephen, does Wolfram Language run on all common platforms, Windows, Mac, Linux?
Absolutely. And in the cloud, on the web. So you can just go, anybody can just go there and go to the Wolfram Language sandbox and start typing in Wolfram Language code and doing all kinds of computations.
And you also have a fairly extensive tutorials about how to learn to code or to speak the language to write in it for beginners as well.
That's true. Yeah, no, and I even wrote a book about called Elementary Introduction to Wolfram Language, which I kind of wrote actually as a book for kids to learn computational thinking and our language. But turns out it works for kids. It's worked great for kids, but it also turns out that it seems to be really good for adults as well. But the thing that I'm particularly keen on there is that there's this wonderful opportunity right now to teach kids computational thinking, which is going to be, computational thinking is sort of the paradigm of the 21st century. It's the sort of big idea that there'll be, there'll be a computational X for every field X, so to speak. And if you know how to do computational thinking, you're positioned to actually be able to pursue sort of that computational X. It's different from computer science. Computer science is a lot of the details of how computers and algorithms and things work. Computational thinking is all about, if I can formulate my thoughts computationally for a kind of arbitrarily smart computer, this is what I can get from that. I think one of the things that's I'm excited about, it's great. You asked me about my hobbies. One of them is like teaching computational thinking to kids. It's a fascinating experience for a language designer like me to actually watch kids trying to use one's language. It's great to see kind of they generalize, and yes, it actually worked the way they thought it would work, and that's terrific. So that's been an important thing. You asked about sort of hobbies and things. I guess another big hobby that I have is doing things about history of technology and history of science. That's a place where, I don't know how people used to do history, but today, being able to use, the Internet Archive and scanned books and all these kinds of things is absolutely critical. It's bizarre. I've been trying to track down something recently that's a strange piece of paper that I found in a book that somebody gave me. The piece of paper seems to come from 1935, and I think it was written by a very famous person. We'll see how this comes out and whether I'm right. I won't say who it is yet, because otherwise it'll jinx the process of figuring it out. But if it was as I think it was, it is a super interesting artifact. But trying to nail that down and figuring out, I found the watermark on the piece of paper, where on earth does that watermark come from, and so on. If it wasn't for all the stuff that's been scanned and put on the web, that would be impossible. And I have no idea how people used to do history before you could look things up like that.
Right. And I highly recommend some of your columns. In fact, you published a book of many of your essays that kind of did some of that history into thinkers that you admire. And I recommend
yes.
that as well.
Yes, yes. It's a book called Idea Makers. And it's, I always enjoy trying to understand how things that exist in the world actually came to exist. And it's somehow, I think a lot of people who study things like history of science have this idea that there's magic that happens, that scientists and others sort of do magic, that there's one day where somebody has a great insight and they figure something out. In my personal experience of trying to do science, that's never how it works. You know, it's a long grinding process that goes for years or decades, and you kind of build up a certain way of thinking about things, and then eventually, yes, you notice some particular thing that you're primed for, and then you realize something interesting. And it's always an interesting puzzle when you look at other people's history to see, you know, how can you join those dots to understand how they actually got to where they got to. And it sometimes takes a while, but I've never seen a flash of brilliance, I would say. It's always been a long, grinding
slog of brilliance.
Right.
So I know that you've had some successes in your past columns in researching, finding things out that were not widely known. Was there any kind of research tip or research method that you wish someone had told you about 20 years ago that you kind of discovered on your own that you could pass on, something that you discovered? Well, you know, if you're going to really hunt for something in the internet, on the archives,
yeah,
this is a tip about a way that you found that really helpful that maybe most people don't know.
I would think the main meta point is everything has to make sense. That is, you know, in the end, you can grind it down to the point where there are no, where there's nothing, where I suppose another thing is, and maybe this is a piece of, you know, outrageous egotism on my part, but, you know, I like to sort of imagine how would I project myself into the position that this person was in? And can I understand how they would go from here to there to there? And if I can't, then there's something I haven't found. And just keep going until you find it. And people, and in terms of the actual, you have to be, I mean, yes, you have to have a fair amount of general knowledge for a lot of this kind of searching around for things. And I've certainly, it's a useless tip, but you have, it really helps to know a lot. In other words, you know, it's so common to find things where you thought that what was important was somebody was a biologist, but actually the really important thing was that they were involved with the fisheries board in England. And that was important because, you know, there were all these disputes about fishing rights and, you know, the law of the sea was just getting created and stuff like that. And if you know a decent amount broadly about the world, it's easier not to miss sort of these connections. It's not a very useful tip, but it's kind of like, I would say that the specialist history is more difficult. You know, if you're just concentrating on one thing, it's probably more difficult than if you're prepared to, if you think lots of stuff can affect what you're studying.
I had a tip from a super researcher one point, and the tip was something along the lines of, you have to be willing to go down seven levels, meaning like you find something and you go to the footnote and then you go to the footnote of the footnote, and if you're willing to go down seven levels, or to you ask somebody and they don't know but they refer you to someone else and they don't know, and if you're willing to go seven deep, that you can usually, you need to be able to do that, because that's sort of where those answers will often come.
That's interesting. Look, another tip, I suppose, is always read the primary documents.
Right.
Never believe, I mean, any characterization. And, you know, and sometimes some of that gets pretty complicated, because, you know, it's like I was reading, you know, Charles Babbage's account books. And, you know, I think I know how to read modern financial statements, but these were pretty weird. He was involved with an early life insurance company and figuring out like what was his net worth based on these things. Not so easy.
Well, this is really great. Thank you for sharing with us your passions and giving us a little introduction to some of your inventions, including Wolfram Alpha and the Wolfram Language. Both of them seem incredibly powerful. I wish that I was more of a, that I could program more, but maybe this is a place to start.
But that's the point. You can with this.
I know. You're convincing me.
Right. Cool.
And I would like to try typing while walking, because I walk a lot, but I don't type while I'm walking. And I'm thinking, why not?
You should.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just now you're going to complain when you trip over. And
It's all your fault. I have places where there's. I'm very familiar with the terrain, and I could. Charles Darwin had his famous. He would walk circles in his yard as a way of thinking, and he would trot over exactly the same thing around and around, and it was almost complementative in that sense.
Well, he had this long walk. I've visited his house, actually. He also had, here's a piece of trivia for you. He has this, in his time, tennis was a newfangled fancy thing, and he had a tennis court built, but his tennis court was built based on a picture that he had of a tennis court, which was in perspective. So it's not rectangular.
It's trapezoidal.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I guess there's an advantage on being on one side or the other, right?
Yeah, right. Right.
All right. Well, this is great. Stephen, thank you for taking time your evening. And we really enjoyed it. And we'll have
Sounds good. It's nice to chat. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Stephen.